The Tom Woods Show, episode 2169.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. If you've ever wondered how younger kids can learn authentic American history, we finally have the answer. The Tuttle Twins children's book series now has an American history volume. Check it out at tomwoods.com/history. Hey, folks, Tom Woods here. I'm very glad to have Michael Rechtenwald back on the show. You will remember Michael, of course, as the former Marxist from NYU who came to his senses and became not just an ex-Marxist, but a full-blown convert to our way of looking at the world. He is the author of a whole bunch of books, including Springtime for Snowflakes, Social Justice and Its Postmodern Parentage, Beyond Woke, and Google Archipelago. And I wanted to talk to him today about the ongoing woke issue and woke capitalism and what it all means and what, if anything, can be done about it. Michael, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate your email the other day. You read my email because I was talking about the wokeness episode I had done. And of course, you are the guy because you've written quite a bit, thought quite a bit about this. I was just reading one of your pieces on it. I'm here in New York City for a few days, and I was in one of the increasingly rare 24-hour diners here last night reading Michael Rechtenwald. So I'm glad that we have a chance to talk about this. So how do you want to define a term like, quote, woke capitalism? What does this mean?
Well, you know, it started off to signify something like, you know, political activism on the part of for-profit corporations, right? So it looked like it was simply a PR and an advertising scheme in order to assuage the public and especially coastal leftists and so forth, and to ingratiate corporations to the state, you know, through their representatives and to ward off, you know, antitrust legislation and so forth. But it really is now much more than that. And it's been for a while, actually. I would say it's completely institutionalized at this juncture, such that we have basically a resetting of the whole capitalist order based on this woke capitalism or stakeholder capitalism, as it's also called. And so what it amounts to is a complete rehauling of corporate capitalist production and behavior in general. So I would say that woke capitalism is a institutionalized means by which capitalism is being completely refurbished and reimagined, as they would put it, such that it is in line with the three tenets of stakeholder capitalism, which are the ESG index, which is the ESG index, the environmental, social, and governance index. So woke capitalism is stakeholder capitalism, its alignment with environmental, social, and governance metrics. And so it's environmentalism and it's social. That means social justice. That's the woke aspect. The environmental is the green. So it's green woke. And the governance part is really about how transparent are these corporations to the public and to each other and to the state. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, I think.
This article of yours I read last night starts off by saying people have come up with various theories as to the origins of woke capitalism and why we have it. And so, for example, one of them might be these companies are trying to fend off any future trouble they might get in with the thought police by just overdoing it from the start and being outwardly very ideologically compliant. So there's that. There's several other explanations. And you conclude the beginning of the article by saying, none of these explanations really convince me. So what is your account of where this is all coming from?
Well, I think it's a cartel scheme. It isn't so much simply, I mean, these aspects of woke capital are true, but they're just not sufficient for explaining the entirety of it. So I think it really can be explained in terms of what I call the woke cartel. And that is membership in the woke cartel. It's kind of a shibboleth or a demarcation device for positioning companies with reference to this woke cartel. So if you gain admission to the woke cartel, you're going to get all this capital funding, you know, through the ESG mechanism on the stock market. If you don't comply with the woke cartel, you'll be banished and you'll be starved of capital. And we can see that this really is a political mechanism. This is nothing to do with really, in the end, environmentalism and so forth. Because, I mean, we saw, for example, Elon Musk and Tesla was thrown off of the S&P 500's ESG index because he effectively moved to buy Twitter and declared himself a free speech absolutist. So he came into the crosshairs of the woke cartel, despite the fact that he makes more electric vehicles than any producer in the world, probably, and certainly more than anybody on the S&P 500 ESG index. So this is a political mechanism for dividing the woke wheat from the non-woke chaff.
Where does this ESG index come from? It's not a governmental index. Nobody is, strictly speaking, obligated to abide by it. So what is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's being instituted by, so this is extra-governmental or pre-governmental collusion, really, on the part of the people pushing this ESG index. What it is, there's a couple companies that are primarily responsible for rating these corporations in terms of the ESG score. MSCI is the main one, and they basically rate these corporations based on self-reporting from the corporations and also actually public relations and news items. And so that's where it's coming from. It's pre-governmental. So legislation is likely to follow, but these corporations are looking for a first mover advantage to get out ahead of what's coming legislatively.
Okay. This ESG thing seems to have, maybe it's because I don't follow this particular area of life that closely. It just seems to have come out of nowhere very rapidly, and suddenly right. It's taken over everything, just like that.
Absolutely. It's just amazing. I mean, you have, of course, the major asset managers are on board, all of the top 10 asset managers, including, of course, BlackRock Inc. and State Street and the Vanguard Group and UBS. All of these asset managers are aligned with this, and they are pushing it hard. They're pushing it very hard. What they're doing is actually smuggling ESG abiding stocks into their general portfolios to inflate the value of the ESG. They're also charging 43% more in fees for the ESG abiding or indexed companies. It seemed to come out of nowhere, but it really is a coordinated campaign, largely coming out of the World Economic Forum, frankly, who signed on all these corporate partners to their agenda, the stakeholder capitalism agenda. And now these major asset managers and banks are all in line with this, and they're pushing it very hard. You had, for example, the Bank of America CEO, Brian Moynihan, at the World Economic Forum saying straight up in the last annual meeting that if companies are not above the bar ESG-wise, they're just not going to get loans. They'll be starved of capital. So this is rolled out incrementally, but by signing all these partners onto their agenda, these major corporate partners across the world, the WEF has managed to bring this thing into complete hegemony at this point.
I know you're working on a book on the Great Reset, so I know I can ask you a question like this. This World Economic Forum, yeah, I'm sure some people had their eye on it before a couple of years ago, but now a lot of people know about it. And I'm not sure that's the way they like it, frankly. They probably preferred to, you know, they have their high-profile meetings, but since nobody's following them, it doesn't really matter. But now people kind of do know a little bit about them, and it doesn't seem especially attractive. How is it possible that this non-governmental entity should be so dominant in the way we've come to think about so many things?
Well, they're very subversive. So the way they've done it is by aligning themselves. First of all, they have a partnership with the UN, and they signed on to an agreement with the UN to push the 2030 agenda, for example. And they promised to provide assets to the UN for so-called digital governance and to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs. So they have aligned with the UN, and then the UN has signed on like thousands of partners also. So they've just worked surreptitiously to avoid the problem of legislation, frankly, and to basically undemocratically, not that I'm a great fan of democracy, but they've undemocratically made these things a fait accompli based on the way they've networked all these people together and organizations.
Let me ask you a question that maybe you're one of the only people I know in the world who could answer it. As a guy who spent many years within academic Marxism, how would a Marxist view the World Economic Forum? Because technically, they view themselves as being capitalists, and they're claiming that this really is what capitalism is supposed to be, and yet they're promoting things that seem to be at odds with it. Is that good enough for a Marxist, or would a Marxist say, these people are interlopers and these people are scammers and they're just in it for their own personal wealth?
That's a great question. So there's a debate within socialism about this right now. There are those socialists who are not technically Marxists who believe that stakeholder capitalism is a means by which to bring about socialism, basically by liquidating capitalist organizations from within. So to penetrate and then effectively liquidate capital by virtue of inserting themselves into these corporations and forcing them into the stakeholder capitalism, they think this will bring socialism about. And then there are the tried and true, you know, orthodox Marxists who say, no, this is never going to work. Any company has to abide by the profit motive. If they don't, they will fail. And likewise, you know, this stakeholder capitalism thing will fail. So there's the orthodox Marxists who would say, yeah, basically what you characterized. They would say that, you know, this is just another move on the part of capitalists to keep their boat afloat, you know, without undertaking the necessary revolutionary steps to overthrow capitalism. So yeah, there's the hard, when I was a Marxist, I would have thought this is just a complete scheme to evade the inevitable class conflict and to try to placate leftists in order to keep capitalism afloat. And, you know, if I believed in climate change, which I did, then I thought that this was just a way to basically buoy up capitalism in the meanwhile until a socialist revolution would happen such that we could overthrow the capitalist order and finally enact the kind of changes that would save us from environmental catastrophe. Now, without catastrophism, the left has nothing. So they're always looking for the next catastrophe to justify their radical interventionism.
Can you just clarify exactly what the term stakeholder capitalism means and how that differs from what we might, I guess, call stockholder capitalism?
Right. So stakeholder capitalism is this idea that in addition to shareholders in a corporation, there are other entities that should be considered with reference to the behavior of a corporate entity. This goes back all the way back to, you know, the 70s when Milton Friedman wrote his famous essay about the only responsibility of a corporation is to make profit. Well, they basically, in the year after that, Klaus Schwab published a book that introduced this stakeholder capitalism, basically suggesting that's not true. The corporation has to be responsible to all its so-called stakeholders. That includes customers, workers, the community, society, and now the planet. So it's a kind of situation where they're looking to change all corporate behavior with reference to these issues and these other so-called stakeholders who are supposedly, they stand to lose or gain from corporate behavior. So regardless of the fact that they don't own any shares in a company, they should nevertheless be considered in all corporate activities.
I want to step back from this material for 1 minute to ask you a question relating to you and your own intellectual development. Then we'll jump back into this. I know your story. We've talked about it a number of times here on the show. And it's a very, very unusual story for somebody you know, let's say past the half century mark, to say, wait a minute, I have to rethink my ideology. That almost never happens, but you did that. Yeah. But what I find interesting, because you just said a minute ago, you were talking about climate change, and you said, which I used to believe in, or you used to think that it was a major problem. I could see somebody saying, I don't think the Marxist framework is correct, but I still think there are, nevertheless, concerns about climate change or concerns about X, Y, and Z issue. And yet it looks like you not only changed your ideology, but you went back and looked at all these individual things and threw them all into question. Is that
absolutely
what happened?
Absolutely. Everything came into question. I realized that many of the dominant narratives really are coming from this perspective, that in fact, socialism is not really simply some sort of a ground-up, bottom-up movement, and that it's actually been foisted on us by elites, if you will, for lack of a better term. And a lot of these dominant narratives, like the climate change catastrophism, as I'll put it, are really not what they are cracked up to be. And so I looked at all of these issues and I had a sea change in general. And then everything came into a different perspective. The whole gestalt just shifted and all the pieces changed their meaning. So indeed, that's exactly what happened.
All right. Now back into this. You have what you're describing as an 8-point plan against the Great Reset that can also be thought of as an 8-point plan dealing with this woke capitalism problem. So can we start going through that?
Sure, absolutely.
All right, so let's go from the beginning. Central bank digital currencies. I mean, obviously, I can't imagine supporting that, and you seem to agree with me.
Absolutely. It's a terrible, terrible prospect. And it's not as if it's completely far off, because the Fed has written a paper, a kind of an exploratory paper, to deal with the question. And they're seemingly behind it. What they want to do is, of course, institute this universal digital currency, at least universal in terms of the United States. And for many reasons, it involves, you know, complete surveillance over money by central banks, of course. And in the case of the US, the Fed, that means all spending, debt, and savings would be transparent to the central bank, because everything is digitized and stored there. And so it would be just a nightmare in terms of what we could spend on and how much we could spend, how much we could save. There could be real-time taxation of any savings over a certain cap. There could be real-time taxation for all transactions. That's federal taxes, not just state. And of course, there could be the possibility of, you know, proscribed sellers and buyers, basically people shut out of transactions because they may be dissident or they may be some other way unacceptable to the establishment. You know, they may be non-woke. It could be possible that they could even exile, you know, people that don't have the right political opinions from certain transactions or all transactions. So it's a totalitarian scheme and a total nightmare, but it's been ruled out in several countries already, the Bahamas and some African countries and some other states. And China has a major pilot ongoing to roll this out. So we're in the exploratory stage in the US, but still, and there's an index where you can track all of this, what countries have gotten CBDCs and which countries are in the pilot stage, et cetera, online. So yeah, I'd say we have to refuse the CBDC, and that is, it can't become a universal mechanism unless people actually abide by it. And therefore, I say keep cash alive, because cash can be stored separately. You know, although it is instituted by the state, by the Fed, and it is a fiat currency, nevertheless, they can't control every aspect of it. You could stash cash under your mattress, for example.
Yeah, they can't track it. That's the thing. They can't track it.
Right. They can't track it. So it's untrackable in that sense. So that's why I say CBDCs have to be rejected. And it can't become universal if people don't use them.
Now, here's the second one. And again, it's hard to believe I'm even saying these things, but I don't put anything past anybody at this point. Reject installation of devices in your body. Now, this is exactly the kind of thing that people would laugh at you for saying. Then when it happens, they'll say, oh, come on, it's only a so-and-so. And then they'll say, you know, or then they'll say, no, it's not really right. happening, but it is. And then it'll be, but of course it's great, you know. So what do you have in mind here?
Well, the fourth industrial revolution, as it's being called by the WEF, is a panoply of technologies that really would constitute a kind of, it would put basically your body on the internet. That is, all of your organ systems and even your brain state could be reported to a centralized database. This sounds, I know it sounds crazy, but they're saying this seriously. And so what they're talking about is, you know, biometric data on the functioning of human corporal bodies and organ systems using wearables. So I would also add, reject wearables, because wearables are a reporting mechanism, and reject installation of devices like, for example, chips. I know it sounds crazy, but they're talking about chips. There was a session at the last annual meeting of the WEF in which this corporate head said, yeah, we're devising a chip that you could ingest and that then will report on all these things about your body. So I said,
your vaccination status.
And your vaccination status.
Yeah, and you think we must have made that video up, but that's a real person who said those things.
Absolutely. And also, they're talking about brain cloud interfaces, which are nanobots. You know, this goes back to my novel Thought Criminal, this was the premise of my novel, that these nanobots would basically attach to the neurons in your neocortex and basically conduct two-way transmission to the cloud. They're actually touting this as a great enhancement. So all of these things will be sold as enhancements to your health, to your thought processes, like you'll have instant access to the internet through this brain cloud interface, and you'll have all this information. You know, this goes back to the singularity of Kurzweil and all that. You'll have all this instant data at your command, but people don't, you know, will fail to process the possibility that this is a true-way transmission, so they'll have access to your brain states and even, if possible, your thoughts. Now, this sounds, like I said, it sounds very science fiction-like, but all of this is on the table and they're developing these technologies. So I would say just resist all of these enticements for enhancements, because the way these will be used will not be in your benefit.
What do you mean by refuse digital identity?
Well, they're going to roll out a digital ID, or I should call it identity. It's more than an ID. It's not identification. It is a complete record of on and offline behavior that will even allow them to infer from previous behavior what your future behavior might be. So this is like a digital collection of all activities, and it would circulate with you whatever you do, and whatever you do would add to this identity. It's like a private little database on you. So this is going to be rolled out probably through banks at first, and then it would attach again to your CBDCs. So it is a complete record of basically all activity. And it is, as the WEF puts it, the digital identity is, quote, the sum total of the growing and evolving mass of information about us, our profiles, and the history of our activities. It relates also to inferences made about us based on this mass of information, which become new data points, end quote. That's from the WEF website. So they're selling this now on the basis of inclusion. So they want to so-called include everybody in this digital identity, and they're selling it because they're saying that 1.1 billion people have no form of identification, you know, at all. So the digital identity would democratize identity and identification to allow everyone to participate in the global economy. But the extension of the digital identity to the poor and otherwise you know, excluded would mean everybody would have a digital identity, and total inclusion means there's no escape from the digital surveillance afforded by this digital identity. So anytime the word inclusion is used, I would say we must think about the totalitarian prospects that it implies.
Unbelievable. I mean, could you imagine 50 years ago thinking that the word inclusion could be turned to a totalitarian end, and yet here we are?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute for me to give you some very, very valuable advice. This is advice that is going to score you a lot of points with your spouse or significant other. It doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. That person you love is going to be so impressed by your creativity and thoughtfulness. And you don't even have to say, I got the idea from Woods. I'm just giving this to you. You can run with it. You can act like it was your idea. That's fine. Whatever promotes happiness and happy relationships in the world is fine with me. And of course, what I'm talking about is the wonderful Happily Date Box, which I've been receiving for nearly 3 years now. Every month, you get an amazing box filled with interesting, fun activities that you can do with your significant other. It's a way to have a date night in. You'll get a music playlist, maybe a little project to work on, games to play, questions that provoke deep and meaningful conversations, intimate moments that bring the two of you together. They're just wonderful. You're just going to love them. And when you say, hey, I subscribed us to this Happily Date Box service, you're just going to be looked at with a loving gaze. You're going to have that loving gaze into your eyes like, ah, I knew I was right choosing you. Okay? You want to get that gaze? You can get that at tomwoods.com/date. Not to mention, if you go to tomwoods.com/date, you get 50% off your first date. So what possible reason would you have? What, do you not like having a loving gaze in your eyes? Come on. So head over to tomwoods.com/date, get 50% off your first date, enjoy time together, and you are welcome. It's not enough to theorize about the free market. Now you have to really live it. You're saying in your
yes.
plan. So what does that mean in practice?
Well, the free market's dead. Long live the free market. That's basically my slogan here. Basically, you've been dealing with a lot of this on your other shows. I know you've had guests on that talk about this, but basically this means practice the free market by networking with free market entrepreneurs and buying from them, farmers markets, creating a network of independent exchange to stay disengaged from establishment institutions as much as possible and to become or remain as entrepreneurial as you can. As you've been setting up, you've been doing this with your school of life, and I think this is great. Of course, you know, it means also no dependence on the state. Now, I should say a slight caveat there. Like, I paid into Social Security all my life, and frankly, I'm taking it. They owe that money to me. So in that case, I have to say I demur, but buy locally, buy from farmers markets, practice the free market, create networks of exchange, and even possibly consider communities. If things get to this point where there's no way to do this as an individual, we'll have to create communities, possibly even, you know, real life local setups, so that people basically move into these communities of freedom from all these impositions.
And when you say divest from ESG stocks, how would we go about doing that? I mean, it would be, we'd be dealing with an awful lot of large companies, I would think.
It's very difficult. I should say this is a very difficult proposition, but I say we need to divest because you're feeding the beast if you're buying these ESG stocks or if you're invested in ESG companies. The way to do it is to go to your broker or whatever and say, listen, I want nothing to do with ESG stocks. I want out of all of them. They may have to go through, if you have mutual funds, for example, it's, you have to extricate them. I would say get out of mutuals because there's no way they're going to be able to keep ESGs out of there. So they're basically making them inextricably wed with other stocks. But I would say try to buy individual stocks in companies that are not ESG reporting. And also, I think we should try to create a situation where we get voting rights in these companies, you know, stockholder voting rights and then basically pulling our resources together in the sense of networking such that we can have influence over these companies vis-a-vis voting rights on stocks. So stay out of the ESGs through divestment from probably mutual funds into individual stocks where you have voting rights, and we can pool our resources in order to form a voting block to keep these companies from becoming bastardized by the ESG.
Well, likewise, when you say remove your money from ESG reporting banks, I would guess in practice that means try to bank with a more local institution than one of the big sprawling ones. Is that what you have in mind?
Yeah, absolutely. For example, I mean, Bank of America is the leading edge in the banking industry of this ESG reporting scheme. So get your money out of those kinds of banks. And you can find out if your bank is ESG friendly or ESG promoting. In fact, most of them are, frankly. It's the smaller banks that are unlikely to be involved because it's a very expensive proposition to be dealing in these reporting. You know, you have to keep track of your own activities and report on that. Then you have to keep these banks, that is, they have to keep track of the ESG status of their customers and the ESG status of their loans, who their loans are going to. So this costs money. This is very expensive. So it's very difficult for smaller institutions, smaller banks to participate. Those are the banks we need to find and to move our money into.
Then, second to last one, put extreme pressure on representatives to protect national sovereignty and individual rights. So I guess you mean make sure that we don't give an inch to any sickos, you know, at the WEF or any other institution that might want to impose crazy nonsense on us.
Or the WHO, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, or the WHO.
So I don't put much stake in electoral politics, especially now, given that, first of all, I think the elections are pretty seriously compromised, but also it's very difficult to find any people that really represent our values in the state. But there are a few, and you've had them on your show, Tom Massey and others. But I would say we need to really pressure our representatives to make sure they're not selling out to this globalist regime, but both in terms of our national sovereignty and our individual rights, because these prospects that they're pushing through will definitely be rights infringing in the sense that the possibility that our speech rights will be curtailed, our rights of individual autonomy and movement could be curtailed. For example, if Biden were to pass, the Democrats are pressuring Biden to declare a national emergency over climate. If that were to happen, we'd be in serious trouble in terms of locomotion, really. And not just that, but energy in general, electricity, everything, because there could be all kinds of dictates coming down as to how much energy you can use. Basically, your carbon, your individual carbon allowance will be tracked. So we need to pressure these representatives to keep, and this is not just nationally, but also locally, local representatives as well, to protect our rights and also to fend off the ESG, because they're able to, and this is possible, that legislation could definitely inveigh against the ESG index imperative.
Then finally, I guess this is been true for us for a while, but network with like-minded individuals and spread the word. And that can be done. That is one thing that, well, let me start this whole thing over again. I'm going to say that I guess probably 15 years ago, I thought that a lot of these new amazing technologies like the internet itself were just unambiguous goods. Now, right. I think they're ambiguous goods. They're still goods because yes. I can still transmit information around the world, and that's not to be despised. But they're mixed because they have been captured for propaganda use by some people. And as we've seen, there are plenty of people in the world who really, they live to consume propaganda. But at the same time, it does allow us to find each other and yes. to organize and to keep each other, you know, from losing our minds, frankly.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this, you mentioned something that I didn't really put in here, but to keep our sanity in the face of all this, because we have to check with each other what we're thinking, because it is just unbelievable the kinds of basically reversive inversions of reality that are being propagated by propaganda. So, you know, to keep our sanity, that's definitely a key. And to spread the word about, you know, all these prospects that are coming down the pike here, we need to keep networking. And that's not just digitally, although that is obviously easier and more, it gives us a broader reach, but also in, you know, in real life, in speaking individually with people, which is harder, I think. It's harder to tell somebody about the Great Reset in person because they think you're a nut, you know, or they think, you know, you must be some sort of a deviant or you're some sort of a dissident. And that's hard to come out in person with people, but I think it's necessary at this point to do so. You just have to have the guts to do it at this juncture because there's too much at stake.
You have a title picked out for your book yet?
Well, the tentative title, and I'm going to rely on Tom Woods for my title, okay?
Oh, no. You're in trouble.
No, I'm not, because you helped me with my last title, Thought Criminal, which I had all kinds of titles before that, and then you said, no, it's Thought Criminal, and I said, okay, because that was just a much better title.
What you don't realize is that one out of 500 times I come up with a good title. That was the one. So we don't want the 499 creeping in. So what's your working title?
I'm going to give you a shot, but here it is. The Great Reset, A Libertarian Perspective.
That's not bad. But you know, that says everything you want to say. I guess my only concern about it is I want more than just libertarians to read it.
I agree. But
yeah,
I think that there'll be people that want to know what a libertarian perspective is on this, despite the fact that they may not be libertarians themselves.
That's true.
You know, I want to foreground the perspective that I'm taking because I think that's essential to put out in front. But we're looking in terms of the free market and individual rights first and foremost, because that's really what's at stake. They're trying to really destroy the free market and they're trying to infringe our rights on a regular basis. So that's why I chose that subtitle. But I'm open to other possibilities, Tom.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that title. Absolutely. I was just thinking that if you had, you know, even though it would probably make you crazy to do it and it would make me crazy to do it, but if you had a more Trumpian kind of subtitle, you could corral a lot of these people who wouldn't read this book under this title, but who need the information. You're going to kind of trick them into sitting down with it, you know?
Oh, that's what I did with Springtime for Snowflakes, was to make it sound like it was like a light jaunt through, you know, about all this stuff, and that it was, you know, light reading, and that, you know, I was just going to, you know, rip on snowflakes all day, but it's not that at all. But I'm still open to other possibilities, and I'm not even sure about putting the phrase The Great Reset in the title, because I think it's broader even than that. But how to characterize it is another story. Like, how else do you talk about this? Global fascism? I don't know what else to call it.
Right. And I mean, to some extent, no title is ever fully satisfactory. You know, it's very hard to get one small string of words to encapsulate everything you want to say. So they're all going to be imperfect to some degree. But I don't think there's anything wrong with what you have now. So I want to recommend people go to your website, though, and check you out, michaelrechtenwald.com, spelled just the way you would think. You can support him, and he deserves it with all the good work he does. You can find out all about him, and my gosh, you're going to find out a lot about Michael Rechtenwald, given all the links on this site, and even sign up for his mailing list, because it's one of those lists you're going to be glad you're on. There's a very small sliver of mailing lists you're going to be glad you're on. Michael's is one of them. So, Michael, thank you very much for talking today, and I can't wait to have you back on to talk about your book.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's great to be here.
Okay, everybody, that's our episode for today. Tomorrow, our brilliant friend, Dan McCarthy, returns to the show. We're going to look ahead to November and see what's in store electorally for the country and see to what extent the overturning of Roe versus Wade and the January 6th hearings will have any bearing on that. So a lot of stuff to talk about tomorrow. Look forward to seeing you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.